This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Red Country, written by Joe Abercrombie, read by Stephen Pacey.
Part 1. Trouble. You that judge men by the handle and the sheath, how can I make you know a good blade? Jedediah M. Grant. Some Kind of Coward.
Gold. Whist made the word sound like a mystery there was no solving. Makes men mad.
Shy nodded. Those that ain't mad already. They sat in front of Stupfer's meat house, which might have sounded like a brothel, but was actually the worst place to eat within 50 miles, and that with some fierce competition. Shy perched on the sacks in her wagon, and whist on the fence, where he always seemed to be, like he'd such a splinter in his arse he'd got stuck there. They watched the crowd.
"I came here to get away from people," said Whist.
Shy nodded. "Now look. Last summer, you could have spent all day in town and not seen two people you didn't know. You could have spent some days in town and not seen two people. A lot can change with a few months and a gold find. Now, Square Deal was bursting at its ragged seams with bold pioneers. One-way traffic, headed west towards imagined riches, some charging through fast as the clutter would allow, some stopping off to add their own share of commerce and chaos. Wagon wheels clattered, mules nickered and horses neighed, livestock honked and oxen bellowed. Men, women and children of all races and stations did plenty of their own honking and bellowing too, in every language and temper. It might have been quite the colourful spectacle, if everywhere the blown dust hadn't leached each tone to that same grey ubiquity of dirt." Whist sucked a noisy mouthful from his bottle.
"Quite the variety, ain't there?"
She nodded. "All set on getting something for nothing." All struck with a madness of hope, or of greed, depending on the observer's faith in humanity, which in Shai's case stood less than brimful. All drunk on the chance of reaching into some freezing pool out there in the great empty and plucking up a new life with both hands, leaving their humdrum selves behind on the bank like a shed skin and taking a shortcut to happiness.
"Tempted to join 'em?" asked Whist.
Shy pressed her tongue against her front teeth and spat through the gap between.
"Not me."
If they made it across the far country alive, the odds were stacked high they'd spend a winter up to their asses in ice water and dig up naught but dirt. And if lightning did strike the end of your spade, what then? Ain't like rich folk got no trouble. There'd been a time Shy thought she'd get something for nothing, shed her skin and step away smiling. Turns out sometimes the shortcut don't lead quite where you hoped, and cuts through bloody country, too.
"Just the rumour of gold turns him mad."
Whist took another swallow, the knobble on his scrawny neck bobbing, and watched two would-be prospectors wrestle over the last pickaxe at a stall while the trader struggled vainly to calm them.
"Imagine how these bastards'll act if they ever close hands around a nugget."
Chai didn't have to imagine. She'd seen it, and didn't prize the memories. "Men don't need much beckoning on to act like animals."
"Nor women, neither," added Whist.
Shy narrowed her eyes at him.
"Why look at me?"
"You're foremost in my mind."
"Not sure I like being that close to your face."
Whist showed her his tombstone teeth as he laughed and handed her the bottle.
"Why don't you got a man, Chai?"
"Don't like men much, I guess."
"You don't like anyone much."
"They started it."
"All of them?"
"Enough of them."
She gave the mouth of the bottle a good wipe and made sure she took only a sip. She knew how easy she could turn a sip into a swallow, and the swallow into a bottle, and the bottle into waking up smelling of piss with one leg in the creek. There were folk counting on her, and she'd had her fill of being a disappointment. The wrestlers had been dragged apart and were spitting insults, each in their own tongue, neither quite catching the details, but both getting the gist. Looked like the pick had vanished in the commotion, more than likely spirited away by a cannier adventurer while eyes were elsewhere.
"Gold surely can turn men mad," muttered Whist, all wistful as his name implied. "So, if the ground opened and offered me the good stuff, I don't suppose I'd be turning down a nugget."
Shy thought of the farm, and all the tasks to do, and all the time she hadn't got for the doing of them, and rubbed her roughed-up thumbs against her chewed-up fingers. For the quickest moment, a trek into the hills didn't sound such a mad notion after all. What if there really was gold up there, scattered on some stream bed in priceless abundance, longing for the kiss of her itchy fingertips? Shy South, luckiest woman in the near country. She slapped the thought away like a bothersome fly. High hopes were luxuries she couldn't stretch to. "In my experience, the ground ain't given aught away. No more than the rest of us misers."
"Got a lot, do you?"
"Eh?"
"Experience."
She winked as she handed his bottle back.
"More'n you can imagine, old man."
A damn stretch more'n most of the pioneers, that was sure.
Shai shook her head as she watched the latest crowd coming through, a set of union worthies by their looks, dressed for a picnic rather than a slog across a few hundred miles of lawless empty.
Folk who should have been satisfied with the comfortable lives they had, suddenly deciding they'd take any chance at grabbing more. Shai wondered how long it'd be before they were limping back the other way, broken and broke, if they made it back.
"Where's Gully at?"
asked Whist.
"Back on the farm, looking to my brother and sister."
"Haven't seen him in a while."
"He ain't been here in a while. Hurts him to ride, he says."
"Getting old. Happens to us all. When you see him, tell him I miss him."
"If he was here, he'd have drunk your bottle dry in one swallow, and you'd be cursing his name."
"I dare say," Whist sighed. "That's how it is with things missed."
By then, Lamb was fording the people-flooded street, shag of grey hair showing above the heads around him for all his stoop, an even sorrier set to his heavy shoulders than usual.
"What did you get?"
she asked, hopping down from the wagon. Lamb winced like he knew what was coming.
27.
His rumble of a voice tweaked high at the end to make a question of it, but what he was really asking was, how bad did I fuck up? Shai shook her head, tongue wedged in her cheek, letting him know he'd fucked up middling to bad.
"You're some kind of a bloody coward, Lamb."
She thumped at the sacks and sent up a puff of grain dust.
"I didn't spend 2 days dragging this up here to give it away."
He winced a bit more, grey-bearded face creasing around the old scars and laughter lines, all weather-worn and dirt-grained.
"I'm no good with the bartering, Shy, you know that."
"Remind me what it is you are good with."
She tossed over her shoulder as she strode for Clay's exchange, letting a set of piebald goats bleat past, then slipping through the traffic sideways on.
"Except hauling the sacks."
"That's something, ain't it?" he muttered.
The store was busier even than the street, smelling of sawn wood and spices and hard-working bodies packed tight. She had to shove between a clerk and some blacker and black southerner, trying to make himself understood in no language she'd ever heard before,
Then around a washboard hung from the low rafters and set swinging by a careless elbow, then past a frowning ghost, his red hair all bound up with twigs, leaves still on and everything. All these folk scrambling west meant money to be made, and woe to the merchant tried to put himself between Shy and her share.
"Clay!"
she bellowed, nothing to be gained by whispering.
"Clay!"
The trader frowned up, caught in the midst of weighing flour out on his man-high scales.
"Shy south in square deal. Ain't this my lucky day?"
"Looks that way. You got a whole town full of saps to swindle."
She gave the last word a bit of air, made a few heads turn, and Clay planted his big fists on his hips.
"No one's swindling, no one," he said.
"Not while I've got an eye on business."
"Me and your father agreed on 27 shy."
"You know he ain't my father, and you know you ain't agreed shit till I've agreed it."
Clay cocked an eyebrow at Lamb, and the Northman looked straight to the ground, shifting sideways, like he was trying and wholly failing to vanish. For all Lamb's bulk, he'd a weak eye, slapped down by any glance that held it. He could be a loving man and a hard worker, and he'd been a fair stand-in for a father to row and pit, and Shy, too, far as she'd given him the chance. A good enough man, but by the dead he was some kind of coward. Shy felt ashamed for him and ashamed of him, and that nettled her. She stabbed her finger in Clay's face like it was a drawn dagger she'd no qualms about using.
"Square deal's a strange sort of name for a town where you'd claw out of business. You paid 28 last season, and you didn't have a quarter of the customers. I'll take 38.
"What?"
Clay's voice squeaking even higher than she'd predicted.
"Golden grain, is it?"
"That's right. Top quality, threshed with my own blistered bloody hands."
"And mine," muttered Lamb.
"Shush," said Shy. "I'll take 38 and refuse to be moved."
"Don't do me no favours,"
raged Clay, fat face filling with angry creases.
"Because I loved your mother, I'll offer 29.
"You never loved a thing but your purse. Anything short of 38, and I'd sooner set up next to your store and offer all this through traffic just a little less than what you're offering."
He knew she'd do it, even if it cost her. Never make a threat you aren't at least halfway sure you'll carry through on.
31, he grated out.
35.
"You're holding up all these good folk, you selfish bitch."
Or rather, she was giving the good folk notice of the profits he was chiseling, and sooner or later they'd catch on.
"They're scum to a man, and I'll hold them up till Jubens gets back from the land of the dead if it means 35.
32.
35.
33, and you might as well burn my store down on the way out."
"Don't tempt me, fat man. 33, and you can toss in a pair of those new shovels and some feed for my oxen. They eat almost as much as you."
She spat in her palm and held it out. Clay bitterly worked his mouth, but he spat all the same, and they shook.
"Your mother was no better."
"Couldn't stand the woman."
Shy elbowed her way back towards the door, leaving Clay to vent his upset on his next customer.
"Not that hard, is it?"
she tossed over her shoulder at Lamb. The big old Northman fussed with the notch out of his ear.
"Think I'd rather have settled for the 27.
"That's 'cause you're some kind of a bloody coward. Better to do it than live with the fear of it. Ain't that what you always used to tell me?"
"Time's shown me the downside of that advice,"
muttered Lamb, but Shy was too busy congratulating herself. 33 was a good price. She'd worked over the sums, and 33 would leave something towards Rose Books, once they'd fixed the barn's leaking roof and got a breeding pair of pigs to replace the ones they'd butchered in winter. Maybe they could stretch to some seed, too, try and nurse the cabbage patch back to health. She was grinning, thinking on what she could put right with that money, what she could build. "You don't need a big dream," her mother used to tell her when she was in a rare good mood. "A little one will do it."
"Let's get them sacks shifted," she said.
He might have been getting on in years, might have been slow as an old favourite cow, but Lamb was strong as ever. No weight would bend the man. All Shy had to do was stand on the wagon and heft the sacks one by one onto his shoulders while he stood, complaining less than the wagon had at the load. Then he'd stroll them across, four at a time, and stack them in Clay's yard, easy as sacks of feathers. Shy might have been half his weight, but had the easier task and 25 years advantage, and still, soon enough, she was leaking water faster than a fresh-dug well, vest plastered to her back and hair to her face, arms pink-chafed by canvas and white-powdered with grain dust, tongue wedged in the gap between her teeth while she cursed up a storm. Lamb stood there, two sacks over one shoulder and one over the other, hardly even breathing hard, those deep laugh lines striking out from the corners of his eyes.
"Need a rest, Shy?"
Shy gave him a look.
"A rest from your carping?"
"I could shift some of those sacks around and make a little cot for you. Might be there's a blanket in the back there. I could sing you to sleep, like I did when you were young."
"I'm still young."
"Ish. Sometimes I think about that little girl smiling up at me."
Lamb looked off into the distance, shaking his head.
"And I wonder, where did me and your mother go wrong?"
"She died, and you're useless?"
Shy heaved the last sack up and dropped it on his shoulder from as great a height as she could manage. Lamb only grinned as he slapped his hand down on top.
"Maybe that's it."
As he turned, he nearly barged into another Northman, big as he was, and a lot meaner looking. The man started growling some curse, then stopped in the midst. Lamb kept trudging, head down, how he always did from the least breath of trouble. The Northman frowned up at Shy.
"What?"
she said, staring right back. He frowned after Lamb, then walked off, scratching at his beard. The shadows were getting long, and the clouds pink in the west, when Shy dumped the last sack under Clay's grinning face, and he held out the money, leather bag dangling from one thick forefinger by the drawstrings. She stretched her back out, wiped her forehead on the back of one glove, then worked the bag open and peered inside.
"All here."
"I'm not going to rob you."
"Damn right you're not."
And she set to counting it. "You can always tell a thief," her mother used to say, "on account of all the care they take with their own money."
"Maybe I should go through every sack, make sure there's grain in 'em, not shit."
Shy snorted.
"If it was shit, would that stop you selling it?"
The merchant sighed.
"Have it your way."
"I will."
"She does tend to," added Lamb.
A pause, with just the clicking of coins and the turning of numbers in her head.
"Heard Glamour Golden won another fight in the pit up near Greyer," said Clay. "They say he's the toughest bastard in the near country, and there's some tough bastards about. Take a fool to bet against him now, whatever the odds." "Take a fool to fight him."
"No doubt," muttered Lamb, always quiet when violence was the subject.
"Heard from a man watched it, he beat old Stockling Bear so hard, his guts came out of his arse."
"That's entertainment, is it?"
asked Shy.
"Beat shit in your own guts."
"That ain't much of a review."
Clay shrugged.
"I've heard worse ones. Did you hear about this battle up near Rostod?"
"Something about it,"
she muttered, trying to keep her count straight.
"Rebels got beat again, I heard. Bad this time. All on the run now. Those the Inquisition didn't get a hold on."
"Poor bastards," said Lamb. Shy paused her count a moment, then carried on. There were a lot of poor bastards about, but they couldn't all be her problem. She'd enough worries with her brother and sister and Lamb and Gully and the farm without crying over others' self-made misfortunes.
"Might be they'll make a stand-up at Molkova, but they won't be standing long."
Clay made the fence creak as he leaned his soft bulk back on it, hands tucked under his armpits with the thumbs sticking up.
"War's all but over, if you can call it a war, and there's plenty of people shook off their land. Shook off, or burned out, or lost what they had. Passes are opened up, Ships coming through. Lots of folks seeing their fortune out west all of a sudden.
He nodded at the dusty chaos in the street, still boiling over, even as the sun set.
This here's just the first trickle. There's a flood coming.
Lamb sniffed.
Like as not, they'll find the mountains ain't one great piece of gold, and soon come flooding back the other way.
Some will. Some will put down roots. The Union'll be coming along after. However much land the Union get, they always want more. And what with that find out west, they'll smell money. That vicious old bastard Sarmis is sitting on the border and rattling his sword for the Empire. But his sword's always rattling. Won't stop the tide, I reckon.
Clay took a step closer to Shai and spoke soft, like he had secrets to share.
I heard tell there's already been Union agents in Hormring, talking annexation.
They're buying folk out.
They'll have a coin in one hand, sure, but they'll have a blade in the other. They always do. We should be thinking about how we'll play it if they come to square deal. We should stand together, those of us been here a while.
I ain't interested in politics.
Chai wasn't interested in anything might bring trouble. Most of us aren't, said Clay. But sometimes politics takes an interest in us all the same. The Union'll be coming and they'll bring law with them.
"Law don't seem such a bad thing," Shai lied.
"Maybe not, but taxes follow law quick as the cart behind the donkey."
"Can't say I'm an enthusiast for taxes."
"Just a fancier way to rob a body, ain't it? I'd rather be thieved honest with mask and dagger than have some bloodless bastard come at me with pen and paper."
"Don't know about that," muttered Shai.
None of those she'd robbed had looked too delighted with the experience, and some a lot less than others.
She let the coin slide back into the bag and drew the string tight.
"How's the count?" asked Clay. "Anything missing?"
"Not this time, but I reckon I'll keep watching just the same." The merchant grinned.
"I'd expect no less."
She picked out a few things they needed, salt, vinegar, some sugar, since it only came in time to time, a wedge of dried beef, half a bag of nails, which brought the predictable joke from Clay that she was half a bag of nails herself, which brought the predictable joke from her that she'd nail his fruits to his leg, which brought the predictable joke from Lamb that Clay's fruits were so small she might not get a nail through. They had a bit of a chuckle over each other's quick wits. She almost got carried away and bought a new shirt for Pitt, which was more than they could afford, good price or other price. But Lamb patted her arm with his gloved hand, and she bought needles and thread instead, so she could make him a shirt from one of Lamb's old ones. She probably could have made 5 shirts for Pitt from one of Lamb's. The boy was that skinny. The needles were a new kind, Clay said, was stamped out of a machine in Adua, hundreds at a press. And Shai smiled as she thought what Gully would say to that, shaking his white head at them and saying, "Needles from a machine. What'll be thought of next?" While Ro turned them over and over in her quick fingers, frowning down as she worked out how it was done. Shai paused in front of the spirits to lick her lips a moment, glass gleaming amber in the darkness, then forced herself on without, haggled harder than ever with Clay over his prices, and they were finished.
"Never come to this store again, you mad bitch!"
the trader hurled at her as she climbed up onto the wagon seat alongside Lamb.
"You've damn near ruined me!"
"Next season?"
He waved a fat hand as he turned back to his customers.
"Aye, see you then."
She reached to take the break off and almost put her hand in the beard of the Northman Lamb knocked into earlier. He was standing right beside the wagon, brow all ploughed up, like he was trying to bring some foggy memory to mind, thumbs tucked into a sword belt, big simple hilt close to hand. A rough style of character, a scar born near one eye and jagged through his scraggy beard. Shai kept a pleasant look on her face as she eased her knife out, spinning the blade about so it was hidden behind her arm. Better to have steel to hand and find no trouble than find yourself in trouble with no steel to hand. The Northman said something in his own tongue. Lamb hunched a little lower in his seat, not even turning to look. The Northman spoke again. Lamb grunted something back, then snapped the reins, and the wagon rolled off, Shai swaying with the jolting wheels. She snatched a glance over her shoulder when they'd gone a few strides down the rutted street. The Northman was still standing in their dust, frowning after them. What did he want? Nothing. She slid her knife into its sheath, stuck one boot on the rail, and sat back, settling her hat brim low so the setting sun wasn't in her eyes. The world's brimming over with strange people, all right. You spend time worrying what they're thinking, you'll be worrying all your life. Lamb was hunched lower than ever, like he was trying to vanish into his own chest. Shai snorted. You're such a bloody coward. He gave her a sideways look, then away.
There's worse a man can be.
They were laughing when they clattered over the rise and the shallow little valley opened out in front of them. Something Lamb had said. He'd perked up when they left town, as usual, never at his best in a crowd. It gave Shai's spirits a lift besides, coming up that track that was hardly more than two faded lines through the long grass. She'd been through black times in her younger years, midnight black times, when she thought she'd be killed out under the sky and left to rot, or caught and hanged and tossed out unburied for the dogs to rip at. More than once, in the midst of night sweated through with fear, she'd sworn to be grateful every moment of her life, if fate gave her the chance to tread this unremarkable path again. Eternal gratitude hadn't quite come about, but that's promises for you. She still felt that bit lighter as the wagon rolled home. Then they saw the farm, and the laughter choked in her throat, and they sat silent while the wind fumbled through the grass around them. Shai couldn't breathe, couldn't speak, couldn't think, all her veins flushed with ice water. Then she was down from the wagon and running.
Shai!
Lamb roared at her back, but she hardly heard, head full of her own rattling breath. Pounding down the slope, land and sky jolting around her. Through the stubble of the field they'd harvested not a week before, over the trampled down fence and the chicken feathers crushed into the mud. She made it to the yard, what had been the yard, and stood helpless. The house was all dead charred timbers and rubbish, and nothing left standing but the tottering chimney stack. No smoke. The rain must have put out the fires a day or two before. But everything was burned out. She ran around the side of the blacked wreck of the barn, whimpering a little now with each breath. Gully was hanged from the big tree out back. They'd hanged him over her mother's grave and kicked down the headstone. He was shot through with arrows. Might have been a dozen, might have been more. Shai felt like she was kicked in the guts, and she bent over, arms hugged around herself, and groaned, and the tree groaned with her, as the wind shook its leaves and set Gully's corpse gently swinging. Poor old harmless bastard. He'd called to her as they'd rattled off on the wagon, said she didn't need to worry, cause he'd look to the children, and she'd laughed at him and said she didn't need to worry, cause the children would look to him. And she couldn't see nothing for the aching in her eyes and the wind stinging at them, and she clamped her arms tighter, feeling suddenly so cold nothing could warm her. She heard Lamb's boots thumping up, then slowing, then coming steady until he stood beside her.
Where are the children?
They dug the house over and the barn, slow and steady and numb to begin with. Lamb dragged the scorched timbers clear, while Shai scraped through the ashes, sure she'd scrape up Pitt and Rose bones. But they weren't in the house, nor in the barn, nor in the yard. Wilder now, trying to smother her fear, and more frantic, trying to smother her hope, casting through the grass and clawing at the rubbish. But the closest Shai came to her brother and sister was a charred toy horse Lamb had whittled for Pitt years past, and the scorched pages of some of Rose's books she let blow through her fingers. The children were vanished. She stood there, staring into the wind,
back of one raw hand against her mouth and her chest going hard. Only one thing she could think of.
"They're stolen," she croaked.
Lamb just nodded, his grey hair and his grey beard all streaked with soot.
"Why?" "I don't know."
She wiped her blackened hands on the front of her shirt and made fists of them.
"We gotta get after."
"Aye."
She squatted down over the chewed-up sod around the tree, wiped her nose and her eyes, followed the tracks bent over to another battered patch of ground. She found an empty bottle trampled into the mud, tossed it away. They'd made no effort at hiding their sign, horse prints all around circling the shells of the buildings.
"I'm guessing there's about 20. Might have been 40 horses, though. They left the spare mounts over here."
"To carry the children, maybe?"
"Carry 'em where?"
Lamb just shook his head. She went on, keen to say anything that might fill the space, keen to set to work at something so she didn't have to think.
"My way of looking at it, they came in from the west and left going south, left in a hurry."
"I'll get the shovels. We'll bury Gully."
They did it quick. She shinned up the tree, knowing every foot and handhold. She used to climb it long ago, before Lamb came, while her mother watched and Gully clapped, and now her mother was buried under it and Gully was hanged from it, and she knew somehow she'd made it happen. You can't bury a past like hers and think you'll walk away laughing. She cut him down and broke the arrows off and smoothed his bloody hair while Lamb dug out a hole next to her mother. She closed his popping eyes and put a hand on his cheek, and it was cold. She looked so small now and so thin, she wanted to put a coat on him, but there was none to hand. Lamb lowered him in a clumsy hug, and they filled the hole together, and they dragged her mother's stone up straight again and tramped the thrashing grass around it, ash blowing on the cold wind in specks of black and grey, whipping across the land and off to nowhere.
"Should we say something?" asked Shai.
"I've nothing to say."
Lamb swung himself up onto the wagon seat. Might still have been an hour of light left.
"We ain't taking that," said Shai. "I can run faster than those bloody oxen."
"Not longer, though, and not with gear, and we'll do no good rushing at this. They've got, what, 2-3 days' start on us? And they'll be riding hard. 20 men, you said?" "We have to be realistic, Shai."
"Realistic?"
she whispered at him, hardly able to believe it.
"If we chase after on foot and don't starve or get washed away in a storm, and if we catch 'em, what then? We're not armed even, not with more than your knife. No, we'll follow on fast as Scale and Calder can take us." Nodding at the oxen, grazing a little while they had the chance. "See if we can pair a couple off the herd, work out what they're about."
"Clear enough what they're about," she said,
pointing at Gully's grave.
"And what happens to Row and Pitt while we're fucking following on?"
She ended up screaming it at him, voice splitting the silence, and a couple of hopeful crows taking flight from the tree's branches. The corner of Lamb's mouth twitched, but he didn't look at her.
"We'll follow."
Like it was a fact agreed on.
"Might be we can talk this out. Buy 'em back."
"Buy 'em? They burn your farm, and they hang your friend, and they steal your children, and you want to pay 'em for the privilege? You're such a fucking coward!"
Still he didn't look at her.
"Sometimes a coward's what you need."
His voice was rough, clicking in his throat.
"No shed blood's going to unburn this farm now, nor unhang Gully neither. That's done. Best we can do is get back the little ones any way we can. Get 'em back safe."
This time the twitch started at his mouth and scurried all the way up his scarred cheek to the corner of his eye.
"Then we'll see."
Shai took a last look as they lurched away towards the setting sun. Her home, her hopes. how a day can change things about. Naught left but a few scorched timbers poking at the pinking sky. You don't need a big dream. She felt about as low as she ever had in all her life, and she'd been in some bad, dark, low-down places. Hardly had the strength all of a sudden to hold her head up.
"Why'd they have to burn it all?" she whispered.
"Some men just like to burn," said Lam. Shai looked around at him, the outline of his battered frown showing below his battered hat, the dying sun glimmering in one eye, and thought how strange it was that he could be so calm. A man who hadn't the guts to argue over prices, thinking death and kidnap through, being realistic about the end of all they'd worked for.
"How can you sit so level?" she whispered at him. Like you knew it was coming."
Still, he didn't look at her. "It's always coming." The Easy Way.
"I have suffered many disappointments."
Nicomo Koska, Captain General of the Company of the Gracious Hand, leaned back stiffly upon one elbow as he spoke.
"I suppose every great man faces them, abandons dreams wrecked by betrayal, and finds new ones to pursue."
He frowned towards Mulkova, columns of smoke drifting from the burning city and up into the blue heavens.
"I have abandoned very many dreams."
"That must have taken tremendous courage," said Zwarbrek, eyeglasses briefly twinkling as he looked up from his notes.
"Indeed. I lose count of the number of times my death has been prematurely declared by one optimistic enemy or another. 40 years of trials, struggles, challenges, betrayals. Live long enough, you see everything ruined."
Koska shook himself from his reverie.
"But it hasn't been boring, at least. What adventures along the way, eh, Temple?"
Temple winced. He had borne personal witness to 5 years of occasional fear, frequent tedium, intermittent diarrhea, failure to avoid the plague, and avoiding fighting as if it was the plague. But he was not paid for the truth. Far from it.
"Heroic," he said.
"Temple is my notary. He prepares the contracts and sees them honored. One of the cleverest bastards I ever met. How many languages do you speak, Temple?"
"Fluently, no more than 6.
"Most important man in the whole damn company, apart from me, of course."
A breeze washed across the hillside and stirred the wispy white hairs about Koska's liver-spotted pate.
"I so look forward to telling you my stories, Zwarbrek."
Temple restrained another grimace of distaste.
"The Siege of Dagoska,"
which ended in utter disaster.
"The Battle of Afieri,"
shameful debacle.
"The Years of Blood," sides changed like shirts. "The Kadiri Campaign,"
drunken fiasco.
"I even kept a goat for several years, a stubborn beast but loyal. You'd have to give her that."
Zwarbrek achieved the not inconsiderable feat of performing an obsequious bow while sitting cross-legged against a slab of fallen masonry.
"I have no doubt my readers will thrill to your exploits."
"Enough to fill 20 volumes.
3 will be more than adequate."
"I was once Grand Duke of Visserine, you know."
Koska waved down attempts at abasement, which had in fact not happened.
"Don't worry. You need not call me Excellency. We're all informal here in the company of the Gracious Hand, are we not, Temple?"
Temple took a long breath.
"We are all informal."
Most of them were liars, all of them were thieves, some of them were killers. Informality was not surprising.
"Sergeant Friendly has been with me even longer than Temple, ever since we deposed Grand Duke Orso and placed Monscaro Makato on the throne of Tarlins."
Swarbrick looked up.
You know the Grand Duchess?
Intimately.
I consider it no exaggeration to say I was her close friend and mentor. I saved her life at the Siege of Muris, and she mine. The story of her rise to power is one I must relate to you at some stage, a noble business. There are precious few persons of quality I have not fought for or against at one time or another. Sergeant Friendly?
The necklace sergeant looked up, face a blank slab.
What have you made of your time with me?
I preferred prison.
And he returned to rolling his dice, an activity which could fully occupy him for hours at a time.
He is such a wag, that one!
Cosco waved a bony finger at him, though there was no evidence of a joke. In 5 years, Temple had never heard Sergeant Friendly make a joke.
Swarbrick, you will find the company alive with joshing good fun.
Not to mention simmering feuds, punishing laziness, violence, disease, looting, treachery, drunkenness, and debauchery fit to make a devil blush.
These 5 years, said Temple, I've hardly stopped laughing.
There was a time he had found the old man's stories hilarious, enchanting, stirring. A magical glimpse of what it was to be without fear. Now they made him feel sick. Whether Temple had learned the truth, or Cosca had forgotten it, it was hard to say. Perhaps a little of both.
Yes, it's been quite a career. Many proud moments, many triumphs, but defeats, too. Every great man has them. Regrets are the cost of the business, Cezine always used to say. People have often accused me of inconsistency, but I feel that I have always, at any given junction, done the same thing. Exactly what I pleased.
The aged mercenary's fickle attention having wandered back to his imagined glorious past, Temple began to ease away, slipping around a broken column.
I had a happy childhood, but a wild youth, filled with ugly incidents, and at 17, I left my birthplace to seek my fortune with only my wits, my courage, and my trusty blade.
The sounds of boasting mercifully faded as Temple retreated down the hillside, stepping from the shadow of the ancient ruin and into the sun. Whatever Cosca might say, there was little joshing good fun going on down here. Temple had seen wretchedness. He had lived through more than his share. But he had rarely seen people so miserable as the company's latest batch of prisoners. A dozen of the fearsome rebels of Starikland chained naked, bloody, filthy, and dead-eyed to a stake in the ground. It was hard to imagine them a threat to the greatest nation in the circle of the world. It was hard to imagine them as humans. Only the tattoos on their forearms showed some last futile defiance. Fuck the Union. Fuck the King, read the nearest, a line of bold script from elbow to wrist. A sentiment with which Temple had increasing sympathy. He was developing a sneaking feeling he had found his way onto the wrong side. Again. But it's not always easy to tell when you're picking. Perhaps, as Cardia once told him, you're on the wrong side as soon as you pick one. But it had been Temple's observation that it was those caught in the middle that always get the worst of it. And he was done with getting the worst. Sophine stood by the prisoners, an empty canteen in one hand.
"What are you about?" asked Temple. "He is wasting water," said Burmy, lounging in the sun nearby and scratching at his blonde beard.
"On the contrary," said Sophine. I am trying to administer God's mercy to our prisoners.
One had a terrible wound in his side, undressed. His eyes flickered, his lips mouthed meaningless orders, or meaningless prayers. Once you could smell a wound, there was little hope. But the outlook for the others was no better.
If there is a God, he is a smarmy swindler and never to be trusted with anything of importance, muttered Temple. Mercy would be to kill them.
Burmy concurred. I've been saying so.
But that would take courage.
Safine lifted his scabbard, offering up the hilt of his sword.
Have you courage, Temple?
Temple snorted. Safine let the weapon drop.
Nor I. And so I give them water, and have not enough even of that. What is happening at the top of the hill?
We await our employers. The old man is feeding his vanity.
It's a hell of an appetite to satisfy, said Burmy, picking daisies and flicking them away.
Bigger every day. It rivals Safine's guilt.
This is not guilt, said Safine, frowning towards the prisoners. This is righteousness. Did the priests not teach you that?
Nothing like a religious education to cure a man of righteousness, muttered Temple. He thought of Hadish Kadia speaking the lessons in the plain white room, and his younger self scoffing at them. Charity, mercy, selflessness. How conscience is that piece of himself that God puts in every man. A splinter of the divine. One that Temple had spent long years struggling to prize out. He caught the eye of one of the rebels, a woman, hair tangled across her face. She reached out as far as the chains would allow. For the water or the sword, he could not say. Grasp your future, called the words inked into her skin. He pulled out his own canteen, frowned as he weighed it in his hand.
Some guilt of your own? Asked Safine.
It might have been a while since he wore them, but Temple had not forgotten what chains felt like.
How long have you been a scout? He snapped.
18 years.
You should know by now that conscience is a shitty navigator.
It certainly doesn't know the country out here, added Burmy. Safine spread wide his hands.
Who then shall show us the way?
Temple!
Koska's cracked howl floating from above.
Your guide calls, said Safine. You will have to give them water later.
Temple tossed him the canteen as he headed back up the hillside.
You do it. Later the Inquisition will have them.
Always the easy way, eh, Temple? Called Safine after him.
Always, muttered Temple.
He made no apology for it.
Welcome, gentlemen, welcome!
Koska swept off his outrageous hat as their illustrious employers approached, riding in tight formation around a great fortified wagon. Even though the old man had, thank God, quit spirits yet again a few months before, he still seemed always slightly drunk. There was a floppy flourish to his knobbly hands, a lazy drooping of his withered eyelids, a rambling music to his speech. That, and you could never be entirely sure what he would do or say next. There had been a time Temple had found that constant uncertainty thrilling, like watching the lucky wheel spin and wondering if his number would come up. Now it felt more like cowering beneath a storm cloud and waiting for the lightning.
General Koska.
Superior Pike, head of His August Majesty's Inquisition in Starikland, and the most powerful man within 500 miles, was the first to dismount. His face was burned beyond recognition, eyes darkly shadowed in a mask of mottled pink, the corner of his mouth curled up in what was either a smile or a trick of the ravages of fire. A dozen of his hulking practicals, dressed and masked in black and bristling with weaponry, arranged themselves watchfully about the ruin. Koska grinned across the valley towards the smouldering city, unintimidated.
Mukova burns, I see.
Better that it burn in Union hands than prosper under the rebels, said Inquisitor Lawson as he got down, tall and gaunt, his eyes bright with zeal.
Temple envied him that, to feel certain in the right, no matter what wrongs you took part in.
Quite so, said Koska, a sentiment with which her citizens no doubt all agree. Sergeant Friendly, you know, and this is Master Temple, notary to my company.
General Brint dismounted last, the operation rendered considerably more difficult since he had lost most of an arm at the Battle of Osrum, along with his entire sense of humour, and wore the left sleeve of his crimson uniform folded and pinned to his shoulder. "You are prepared for legal disagreements, then?" he said, adjusting his sword belt and eyeing Temple as if he was the morning plague cart.
"The second thing a mercenary needs is a good weapon."
Koska clapped a fatherly hand on Temple's shoulder.
"The first is good legal advice."
"And where does an utter lack of moral scruple feature?"
"Number 5, said Temple. "Just behind a short memory and a ready wit."
Superior Pike was considering Swarbrick still scribbling notes.
"And on what does this man advise you?"
"That is Spillian Swarbrick, my biographer." "No more than a humble teller of tales?"
Swarbrick gave the superior a flamboyant bow.
"Though I freely confess that my prose has caused grown men to weep."
"In a good way?" asked Temple. If he heard, the author was too busy praising himself to respond.
"I compose stories of heroism and adventure to inspire the Union citizens. Widely distributed now via the wonders of the new Rimaldi printing press. You've heard, perhaps, of my Tales of Harad the Great in 5 volumes?
Silence.
"In which I mine the mythic splendor of the origin of the Union itself?
Silence.
Or the 8-volume sequel, The Life of Casimir, Hero of Angland?
Silence.
In which I hold up the mirror of past glories to expose the moral collapse of the present day?
No. Pike's melted face betrayed no emotion.
"I will have copies sent to you, Superior."
"You could use readings from them to force confessions from your prisoners," murmured Temple under his breath. "Do not trouble yourself," said Pike.
"No trouble. General Koska has permitted me to accompany him on his latest campaign while he relates the details of his fascinating career as a soldier of fortune. I mean to make him the subject of my most celebrated work to date."
The echoes of Swarbrick's words faded into a crushing silence. "Remove this man from my presence," said Pike. "His manner of expression offends me." Swarbrick backed down the hillside with an almost reckless speed, shepherded by 2 practicals. Koska continued without the slightest hint of embarrassment.
"General Brint,"
and he seized the general's remaining hand in both of his.
"I understand you have some concerns about our participation in the assault."
"It was the lack of it that bothered me,"
snapped Brint, twisting his fingers free. Koska pushed out his lips with an air of injured innocence.
"You feel we fell short of our contractual obligations?"
"You've fallen short of honor, decency, professionalism."
"I recall no reference to them in the contract," said Temple.
"You were ordered to attack. Your failure to do so cost the lives of several of my men, one a personal friend."
Koska waved a lazy hand, as though personal friends were ephemera that could hardly be expected to bear on an adult discussion.
"We were engaged here, General Brint, quite hotly."
"In a bloodless exchange of arrows."
"You speak as though a bloody exchange would be preferable."
Temple held out his hand to Friendly. The sergeant produced the contract from an inside pocket.
"Clause 8, I believe."
He swiftly found the place and presented it for inspection.
"Technically, any exchange of projectiles constitutes engagement. Each member of the company is, in fact, due a bonus as a result."
Brint looked pale.
"A bonus, too? Despite the fact that not one man was wounded?"
Koska cleared his throat.
"We do have a case of dysentery."
"Is that a joke?"
"Not to anyone who has suffered the ravages of dysentery, I assure you."
"Clause 19,
paper crackled as Temple thumbed through the densely written document. "Any man rendered inactive by illness during the discharge of his contractual obligations is to be considered a loss to the company. A further payment is therefore due for the replacement of losses, not to mention those for prisoners taken and delivered
It all comes down to money, doesn't it?
Koska shrugged so high his gilt epaulets tickled his earlobes.
What else would it come down to? We are mercenaries. Better motives we leave to better men.
Brint gazed at Temple, positively livid.
You must be delighted with your wriggling, you Gurkish worm.
You were happy to put your name to the terms, General. Temple flipped over the back page to display Brint's overwrought signature.
My delight, or otherwise, does not enter the case, nor does my wriggling, and I am generally agreed to be half Dagoskan, half Styrian, since you bring my parentage into—
You're a brown bastard son of a whore!
Temple only smiled. My mother was never ashamed of her profession. Why should I be?
The general stared at Superior Pike, who had taken a seat on a lichen-splattered block of masonry, produced a haunch of bread, and was trying to entice birds down from the crumbling ruin with faint kissing sounds.
Am I to understand that you approve of this licensed banditry, Superior? This contractual cowardice? This outrageous—
General Brint. Pike's voice was gentle, but somewhere in it had a screeching edge which, like the movement of rusty hinges, enforced wincing silence.
We all appreciate the diligence you and your men have displayed, but the war is over. We won.
He tossed some crumbs into the grass and watched a tiny bird flit down and begin to peck.
It is not fitting that we quibble over who did what. You signed the contract. We will honor it. We are not barbarians.
We are not! Brint gave Temple, then Koska, then Friendly a furious glare. They were all, each in his way, unmoved.
I must get some air. There is a sickening stench here!
And with some effort, the general hauled himself back into his saddle, turned his horse, and thundered away, pursued by several aides-de-camp.
I find the air quite pleasant, said Temple brightly, somewhat relieved that confrontation at least was over.
Pray forgive the general, said Pike. He is very much committed to his work.
I try always to be forgiving of other men's foibles, said Koska. I have enough of my own, after all.
Pike did not attempt to deny it.
I have further work for you, even so. Inquisitor Lawson, could you explain?
And he turned back to his birds, as though his meeting was with them, and the rest a troublesome distraction. Lawson stepped forward, evidently relishing his moment.
The rebellion is at an end. The Inquisition is weeding out all those disloyal to the crown. Some few rebels have escaped, however, scattering through the passes and into the uncivilized west, where, no doubt, they will foment new discord.
Cowardly bastards!
Koska slapped at his thigh.
Could they not stand and be slaughtered like decent men? I'm all for fermentation, but fomentation is a damned imposition.
Lawson narrowed his eyes as though at a contrary wind and ploughed on.
For political reasons, His Majesty's armies are unable to pursue them.
Political reasons? Offered Temple. Such as a border?
Precisely, said Lawson.
Koska examined his ridged and yellowed fingernails.
Oh, I've never taken those very seriously.
Precisely, said Pike. We want the company of the Gracious Hand to cross the mountains and pacify the near country as far west as the Sockwire River. This rot of rebellion must be excised once and for all.
Lawson cut at imaginary filth with the edge of his hand, voice rising as he warmed to his subject.
We must clean out this sink of depravity, which has too long been allowed to fester on our border. This overflowing latrine, this backed-up sewer, endlessly disgorging its ordure of chaos into the Union.
Temple reflected that, for a man who professed himself opposed to ordure, Inquisitor Lawson certainly relished a ship-based metaphor.
Well, no one enjoys a backed-up sewer, conceded Koska.
except the sewer men themselves, I suppose, who scratch out their wretched livings in the sludge. Unblocking the drains is a speciality of ours, isn't it, Sergeant Friendly?
The big man looked up from his dice long enough to shrug.
Temple is the linguist, but perhaps I might